Hello, it's Robert Bathurst here. I was one of the first guests on My Time Capsule, and Mike has asked me to tell you that you can now listen to the podcast ad-free by subscribing to Acast Plus. Details of how to join are in the description of each episode. Mike says it's very reasonably priced. In fact, Mike says it's a bargain. And who am I to disagree, locked here in his cellar? Anyway, for a small subscription, Acast Plus, My Time Capsule, ad-free. Free. Unlike me.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, and welcome to My Time Capsule. I'm Mike Fenton-Stevens, and this is the podcast where I talk to my guests about the five things that they would like to put into a time capsule. They can choose four things that they really treasure, but they also pick one thing from their life that they would like to reject, something they'd like to bury in the ground and never have to think about again. My special guest in this episode is the writer, poet, TV and film producer, Henry Norwell, founder of the Manchester Poetry Festival and recipient of a special BAFTA for services to television. He was the co-founder of Baby Cow Productions, which he set up with Steve Coogan in 1999 and managed until his retirement in 2016. In that time, Baby Cow was responsible for hundreds of television programmes and films, including the wonderful film Philomena, Gavin and Stacey, Uncle, Red Dwarf, The Mighty Boosh, Marion and Jeff, Nighty Night, and Alan Partridge, among many others. Henry also co-wrote and script-edited The Mrs. Merton Show and The Royal Family. He's now back on the road performing his poetry, as he did many years ago when he toured with Pulp. It is an amazing life, but let's find out the four things that Henry treasures and would like to keep safe, and the one thing he'd like to banish from his life, as we listen to his time capsule. My first question would be, does anybody still call you Pete?
Good question. I've got three sisters, and they call me Pete, but my wife calls me Henry, my son calls me Dad. everybody else calls me Henry. It is quite strange when somebody calls me Pete. So as I say, it'll be one of my three sisters.
You can really place people from that sort of thing, can't you? If anybody ever calls me Mickey, I know they know me from school.
Yes, of course. It's quite strange, isn't it, that they say that you take on a personality of a name. I hope so, because I always found Peter, I did think of calling myself Peter Doubt. Peter was supposed to be the Rock, Henry is the King, apparently. So, strictly speaking, I am Elvis, the King of Rock.
Perfect. That's it. Just be careful on the toilet. That's all I'll say. So we're going to chat about five things that you've chosen to put into a time capsule that I've got here. Look at it. Isn't it beautiful?
It's gorgeous. Yes. And so big.
Will it need to be? That's the question. You've chosen five things, so I'm very keen to find out what they are.
Oh, good. Well, the first one, I'll do them in sort of chronological order. The first one is a mince pie from when I was a kid. So up to the age of about eight, I lived in what was affectionately termed the slum district of Nottingham, which is the St Anne's area. And the thing I remember most from it is my mum at Christmas used to cook a big mince pie. Now, not a single little mince pie, because you've got the pastry mince ratio in that is quite dense.
Yeah.
It was a big mince pie. So if you think about it, when you cut a slice of big mince pie, your pastry to mince ratio, apart from, you know, the end bit, is quite full on with mince. There's a sort of a richness to that. And as I say, because we were quite poor at the time, five kids, and we lived in a terraced house, there's a sort of, a luxury to a mince pie that always cheers me up.
Yeah. So was your mum really dedicated? Did she make the mince herself?
Well, you see, back in those days, you didn't get everything made up. Like it'd be short course pastry, but she'd make the short course. She didn't get like a, you know, you do these days, short crust pastry. I'm buffeting, Michael. short crust pastry that you buy at the shop, you'd have to make it up yourself. And so there was a nice, uneven quality to it that everything nowadays, if you look at the fruit and the pies and everything, it's all perfect, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I love the fact that you get burnt bits and, you know, sort of straggly bits and whatever, and that was part of the joy of it for me.
Yeah.
It had that feeling of real life, as opposed to we buy in nowadays into this idea of perfection, which of course, you know, almost all the time, and nothing is perfection.
No, only you and I could achieve that.
Well, yes, with this particular podcast.
Indeed, absolutely, as we're about to prove, yes.
Yeah, I do like that sort of homeliness. And, of course, once you have eaten a good mince pie, it has a nice, warm feeling to it, you know, and you feel sated. So, and I would have more than one slice back in those days, you know. They used to call me Swoop, my mum and dad, because, you know, I'd hover around the dinner table.
So how many pieces were it cut into then? So you've got five of you, five kids, two adults.
Do you know, beyond my pieces, Michael, I wasn't really that bothered. but yes, I suppose it's seven of us in all, isn't there?
Yeah.
So, you know, eight pieces, so I'd have two.
Yeah, there you are, you see. It had to be an even number and you went for the extra one. Yeah. I do love mince pies, and they do throw you right back, don't they, every time you eat one. And nowadays, of course, everybody makes mince pies as if they've been handmade. So if you buy them in, you know, in Waitrose, they'll be deliberately made that way.
You can buy them now from, you know, sort of September, can't you?
Yeah.
Which, you know, I find this whole idea of starting Christmas too early. I like to have Christmas on Christmas Eve and finish it on Boxing Day, just get it done. In fact, for the past 20 years, we don't really do Christmas. We do a very Christmas-light version, shall I say. I do enjoy a few of the attributes of Christmas, but I like to get it over with.
Yeah, I rather like the sense of almost that Dickensian thing of closing the shop slightly early on Christmas Eve, and then off you all go with a tree over your shoulder. I like that idea a lot.
Yes, yes. And you just have half the day off.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Scrooge. Yes. you know, I'd have been a very good Bob Cratchit, to be honest with you.
Yeah. I was making rather merry last night, sir. Well, I think I'm going to put a great big mince pie in there, cut into eight pieces, and yours is clearly the spare one.
Well, two. So one, me share and the spare one, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Because,
you know, when I open this time capsule, I might be a bit hungry, might be a bit peckish. I bet nobody's thought of that before, have they?
No, so basically open it up and it has all the things you need. I should imagine your next item will be a lavatory.
No.
Oh, okay.
No. I mean, back then, of course, the lavatories were, you know, you had to go out the door for the lavatory, because they're back-to-back housing. You went out the door. It's quite weird, isn't it? Because if you speak to people about it, it sounds like that we should be dead. It sounds like it's from a bygone century.
Yeah.
It doesn't actually sound like it's in our lifetime. But, yeah, so we'd bathe in front of the fire. And then at the age of eight, we moved. They knocked it down. It's quite funny, actually, because I think we were the only people in our road.
Yeah.
And there must have been 100 houses in the road who actually owned the house. Why my mum and dad thought to buy a slum? I have no idea. So everybody else's door was green, but my mum was sick of green, so ours was pink. So you could see ours you know, from space, basically. And they knocked it down, and we moved to a council estate. Because obviously we didn't get a lot of money from it. We couldn't afford another house. So we moved to a council estate. And there we had a proper big bathroom. So at the time I thought the council, I thought it was, you know, like a palace. So we had a bathroom. But this is a strange thing. I don't know whether you've come across this, Michael. But downstairs, the toilet wasn't actually in the house. It was right next to the back door.
Yeah.
So it was like in the 80s that they didn't trust you to shit inside if you were working class. You know, they were trying to lure you from down the garden to just next to the back door. I mean, you won't build a house like that anymore, would you?
No. I mean, because quite often that back door is also next to the kitchen. So the last thing
next to the kitchen.
Yeah, you're shitting right next to where you cook your food. That's a great idea.
Yeah, it bonkers when you think about it. Of course, we had an immersion heater. Not that we ever switched it on. I mean, that was you switched that on. That was like DEFCON 3. and French windows we had in this place.
Oh wow, what luxury!
Do you know? It seemed at the time. See, people turn their nose up at council houses, but it seemed at the time, having gone from a place where you know the only garden we had was you know growing on the walls, to a place where you had a front garden and a back garden. Mm. You know, it seemed a huge jump culturally. You know, at the time, my ambition as a kid was really just to play football.
Yeah.
So I would go out onto the road. Now, we lived on a crescent, so no cars came up so we could play football on the road. So you'd play with all the kids. So, you know, it could be 50 kids. And if that's all that wanted to play. And you'd have two parked cars would be the goal.
Yeah.
And you'd just play for, yeah. No idea of time. You'd just play till you got shouted in for your team.
Yeah.
You know, the last two that got shouted in for the team, they'd say, next goal wins. I don't think anybody ever kept score. So, you know, it could have been 300 to 250. You didn't really know. But for me, time seemed to stand still when I was playing football. Mm. I sort of think it's a bit like dancing for lads. That you can use your body and you get very much in the moment as you do with dancing and very healthy, of course. Mm. So I would lose myself in football as a kid. I wasn't particularly good at it. But,
No, me neither.
Yeah.
It was a very annoying thing, though, wasn't it, when that call came? I mean, if you were on the crescent, it would come from your mum saying, you know, Peter.
Yeah.
Come in. Your dinner's ready. And that usually meant lunch.
Oh, dinner was lunch and tea was your evening meal, which was always 6:30.
Yeah.
After the news had regaled you with tales of Vietnam, which was the backdrop to my early teens.
Well, I remember playing football in the summer because our house was next to the rec. So we would play there, great hordes of kids. And slowly people would be called in. And my mum would walk round to the entrance of the rec, which was only about 50 yards from our house. And because we'd always be incredibly hot and sweaty, she used to let us leave one thing.
Oh, no, we weren't allowed to leave anything. You see, it was quite formulaic, my food at that time. So you'd basically join the week, you'd have two things. So you'd have like bacon and tomatoes, sausage and egg, beans on toast. And then on Sunday, you would have more than two things. You would have a big spread. And then for Sunday tea, it was always a bit of the leftovers of the meat, you know, some sort of a salad type thing, often tinned salmon, and then tinned fruit for afters.
Carnation cream?
Oh, yeah. Evaporated milk. Yeah. I suppose that's the same. I mean, pineapple chunks was my favourite, right? not rings. That was just for gammon, which is posh bacon, isn't it? But pineapple chunks. But what we used to get sometimes, which I used to eat, was the mixed fruit. Do you remember the mixed fruit in tins?
Yeah.
Cling peaches was the main constitution of it. And even the word cling. cling, it's like it's clinging to your palate. The cherry content, because I'm very much about percentages, and the cherry content was possibly 1%.
And quite often had a stone in it.
Oh, yes. The other bit, really, which was about a third of it, was pears.
Mm.
So it'd be basically peaches, pears, and then a very little bit, and you'd fish them out, wouldn't you, very little bit. And strangely enough, the tins of salmon used to have them little round white bones in them as well.
Yeah.
You had to fish out. And I always used to think, why don't they fish out the white bones, put them in with the cling peaches and put the cherries in with the salmon, and I'd just eat the salmon. It all gets mixed up when it's in your stomach anyway, don't it?
Yeah. So you, all through your youth, Sunday dinner would be meat and your veg and your potatoes, yeah. And then you would have a pudding.
Yeah, not much of a pudding now on Sunday. I say it'd be Sunday tea when we had a pudding, which
right.
is, I say.
But never a mince pie.
Well, we'd have a mince pie, but you wouldn't necessarily have it after. That might be a middle of the afternoon job. Do you know what I mean? I think mince pie is not constrained by time. You know, it's freelance. It can be like any time. You could have it for breakfast, couldn't you, really?
Oh, yeah, I could. Well, all right, then, when I've got a freelance mince pie inside the time capsule for you, which is brilliant. Okay, that's your first thing. So, Henry, what's number two?
Number two is a picture which I've got here. It's a picture of my mum. A photo of my mum. Now, it is an artifact in that it physically exists. Now, a lot of photos nowadays don't exist, do they? They're in the internet.
Yes.
But this was the only picture we had of my mum. My mum died when I was 11. And a kind man that used to come and sell us clothes actually framed it. This is not the frame. This is a copy of it.
Mm.
And so it nearly didn't exist. You know, it could have got lost, but thanks to Mr. Chambers, I shall name him, who used to come and sell us clothes on the Never Never, we've got it as a physical attribute, and we've got an image of my mum. Now, as I say, she had five kids. The image is actually when she's 21.
She's very beautiful in that picture.
Thank you. I think she's very beautiful. Obviously, I'm a little bit biased. But the strange thing is, if you imagine an 11-year-old, the only image that they've got to look at is a 21-year-old.
Mm.
So it's slightly distorted. Since then, we've got from relatives, we've got some other images of my mum. And as I say, having five kids, I think she died at the age of 39, same as Dylan Thomas. Still very young, as we know, but certainly not 21.
Did you know at the time what she died of?
Oh, yeah, she died of a car crash.
Oh, Lord.
I remember being told it was like a Friday afternoon and we had double games. And so I was keen to go and play football. And the vicar, I know you've played many vicars in your time. The vicar was in the house and he would never come to the house. And so I remember it being a bit strange. And my elder brother, Dave, who's died now, but he was saying, you can't, go and play football. And I was going, oh, I want to go and play football. And then my dad came in and took us both, myself and my older sister, Linda, on his knees and said, your mum's dead. And my sister went ballistic, as only a sort of a gangly teenage girl can do, you know, arms and legs flying everywhere. And I sat there not understanding it at all. So it wasn't, I think, till a couple of days later when I was sitting on my mum's bed that I actually thought about it and understood what had happened.
Mm.
And I would say that's the single biggest change in my life. Because before then, I was very gregarious and very much, I'd probably end up as a fruit and veg seller because my mum had a fruit and veg business. And then afterwards, I read a lot and, of course, became a poet. So as a moment to remember, that was, as I say, a huge change. And so from 11 onwards, my teenage years were different than I'd expected.
Yeah. Oh, God, that's traumatic. I know lots of people go through these traumas, but individually, of course, as you say, life-changing, absolutely life-changing. And it's strange to think of yourself, I think, as the person that didn't happen to, as the person that where your mother didn't die in that car crash, and you become a fruit and veg seller.
I'd probably be very happy
yeah.
As that, you know. But what I found, I don't know whether you found this, and it probably applies to you as well. You don't have to say, but what I found is almost everybody in the creative industries that I've come across, and I've come across hundreds of people, have some moment in their childhood or their teenage years where they've stepped back, and instead of being the center of attention, like and living life in the moment like I would do when I was playing football, they've stopped and they've looked at the world from the outside and tried to understand the world and tried to understand their place in it. And I think what a lot of creativity is that conversation with yourself, yeah, as to try and understand what the world's about and how it all works. And certainly death can bring that on, but illness, parent leaving, all sorts of things can bring it on.
Yeah. I don't think I've ever analysed it, but I know that my childhood, when I look back on it, was fairly traumatic. It was quite violent.
Was that you being violent, Michael?
Well, I was, as a result of being in a violent environment all the time.
Yeah.
I think my parents would be upset if they were still alive and heard me say that. Yeah. But there's no doubt in my mind that we were hit a lot. I mean, and really quite violently. I remember my father, and this is really sad memory, I remember my father coming in, waking me up to spank me as a small boy, being woken up and seeing my dad, and then him having to, he was crying, and he said, you know, I've got to hit you. Because I'd been told, when your father comes home, he's going to smack you. And they go deep, those things.
I think if I go back to, and I don't think parents back in the day were any different than they are now, but I think there was an emphasis on duty, an emphasis on doing the right thing, mm-hmm, on following the rules. And so it was, I think, certainly when I was disciplined, it was about not upholding the laws and traditions.
Yes.
And it's quite strange, isn't it, because we lead these days of parenting, and certainly our generation has passed it on. I don't know about the very young ones, but more from an idea of love, mm-hmm, rather than discipline.
Yes. Well, I think they thought that discipline was love. I think they thought that, yes, they were showing you love by teaching you how to behave.
Yes, yeah, and letting the side down.
Yeah.
You're letting the side down, which is very strange, isn't it, really? And I think maybe it's to do with the aftermath of the war, you know, where everybody had to do their bit, and it was a sort of a team effort, and there was that sort of thing. I know that even now, I know some old people who it's the presentation of doing the right thing and being right, and it's the old thing of nice shiny shoes but holes underneath,
mm-hmm,
that sort of being seen to be a valid member of society is key.
Yes.
So I think for me I started off I had a job at Fine Fair, which for those younger viewers is Lidl without the glamour. Then I got a job as an insurance broker, very steady, basically the careers people said to me, it's either banking or insurance for you, young man.
Yeah.
My dad worked at Raleigh and my brother worked at Raleigh, and there was an expectation that I might work at Raleigh, but I did all right. I got 6 O-levels, so for around my way, which were basically skinheads and greebos. 6 O-levels meant you were Einstein.
Yeah.
So, it was an office job. So I took my head down and worked hard and learnt all the office trade, if there is such a thing, and became the manager of an office in Hull. And this was around 1976. So I was 20. I was born in 56. So I was 20. And, of course, punk hit. Mm-hmm. And when punk and new wave hit, I was head of an office dealing with people who were in their 50s. So everybody I spoke, mm-hmm, to was much older than me. And I got a house and I got my knives in the knife bit and my forks in the fork bit. And I got my furniture. And I was very old. I was a very old 20-year-old. And of course, the record Too Much Too Young came on the radio, and I went to see in Hull, there's a cinema called Cecil, which is a great cinema, Cecil the cinema. I went to see Animal House, if you remember that film.
Yeah.
And they were older than me. If you look at the actors, they're more than 20, and they're having fun. And I remember thinking, what on earth am I doing? I've basically lived my life already. But it was that thing of, that we were talking about, of the doing the right thing and discipline, and I'd bought into it, and I'd done it, but I'd done it by the age of 20. So when punk came, I was ready to say, well, what else is there? And so I retired from insurance and cashed in my pension and tried to become a writer. I went to live with my eldest sister, Linda, in Nottingham, and just wrote as much as I can. Now, I wrote, this is going to sound bonkers, but I wrote 5 chapters of a novel where a museum comes to life at night.
No.
I did. I wish I'd have kept it.
Oh, no.
I abandoned it because I thought it was a little bit childish. I enjoyed the writing. And so from then onwards, from Too Much Too Young and Animal House, from then onwards, the idea of responsibility, you know, was always balanced.
Yeah.
It was always, you've got to live life. And so I had an adventure, as you do. You've not got a proper job either, have you?
Nope. Never.
That's what my dad always say. When are you going to get a proper job? Probably work 2 hours a week and earn more than you can earn at Rally, but it was not a proper job.
No, me too. My mother, for all of her life, every job I ever got, she would say to me, are they paying you? Bless her.
Yeah.
So did you start writing poetry straight after your mum's death or shortly after?
I was probably about 14. Mm. So we'd done a little bit of poetry at school, but I think what it was Spike Milligan that got me into it. So I was a big Monty Python fan, and then I read every comedy book there was in the library, and I bought loads. So anything from James Thurber, Offnong, all the sort of old grey books that you get in the library, all those, and then your Monty Pythons and all the MASH series, you know, and Spike Milligan had all these little books of verse. Mm. So I read those and I thought, oh, they're quite interesting, and I can probably do a few of those. And then I read Spike Milligan wrote a book called Small Dreams of a Scorpion. That came out by the time I was about 14. And I remember crying at a couple of the poems and thinking, he's so funny and yet he can move me. And I love that. There was something that you didn't get in a lot of comedy books. And I was very struck by that idea that you could be funny and you could elicit emotion. So I got more into poetry then. So I started reading the Liverpool poets, who I think are brilliant. And there were some other great poets around at the time, like Adrian Mitchell. I went to the library and I'd get out all the Jonathan Cape books, because Jonathan Cape always had a photograph on the front cover. So it looked modern. It looked, you know, like this, like, you know, the 60s and 70s as opposed to pre-30s. Mm. I read as much as I could of those, and I started writing my own. And obviously, you know, a lot of music around that time. I got a sort of poetic, you know, sort of progressive rock, if you like. I got a poetic feel to it.
So in a way, sort of lyrics, but not. I mean, it's interesting, you could easily have gone down the route of saying, well, I'm going to join a band and I'll be the lyricist.
I have no sense of timing. My dad was a drummer in a jazz band, but I have no sense of time, so I couldn't be a drummer. My brother, elder brother, played the guitar. There was him and another bloke. They were called the No Can Duo. And he used to do all the pubs. And I can't play guitar. He tried to teach me 4 a.m. once, at 4 a.m, and I couldn't get the hang of it. I can't sing. I have actually sang on Packet of Three, when I was on Packet of Three, to 3.4 million viewers. I actually sang a song and played the kazoo, which gives you an idea of the song. And my brother, God bless him, who was a brilliant singer, probably paid to a maximum of 200 people in a pub with kids sliding along the floor as he's singing. He always used to say when he saw me, he'd see me go and do a gig, and I'd have a bit of paper with my set list. And he'd say, is that it? I'd say, yeah. And he'd say, well, I have to get the amp, the guitar, you know, and all the wires and everything, and plug it all in, and say, you just go on with a bit of paper. I think I chose well there, Michael, to be honest.
You did. And I have to say, you've always applied that to all the comedy you've been involved in, I think. The idea that comedy with a bit of heart, with a moment of tragedy, in fact, in it, is better comedy.
Yeah, I think there's a thing. You know, I mean, we worked together on Nighty Night, mm-hmm. and I think with a lot of the comedies, you're trying to say something over and above the joke. It's a little bit like salt or sugar comedy in a way, in that if you wet it on its own, it's not very satisfying, but you sprinkle it onto a bit of drama, you sprinkle it onto a bit of substance, and it makes that better.
Mm. I think that's probably why your shows have such longevity. It's why people can watch them again and again, because you're always finding that little moment where somebody's eyes flick to sadness. Steve is a master of it, and so was Caroline Ahern. Yeah. That thing where you think of Ricky and all sorts of people, they have that skill to be extremely funny and then just for a moment just show the sadness in their eyes.
Yeah, well, I think we crave stories and we crave resolution to stories. I mean, if you think of how many stories we actually watch, you know, in a week, in a month, in a year, throughout his life, you know, we digest them, you know, nearly as much as we do food. You know, so we must have a need for them. And I think we need them. I think we need comedy as well. I read Freud's jokes and their relation to the unconscious when I was younger. I don't know whether you've ever read it.
I haven't, no.
Some of the jokes are in German, and I wouldn't recommend trying them on stage. The gist of it, it's about 400 pages, but I'll give you the gist of it that I gathered from it, was that we laugh because we recognise our own imperfection.
Mm.
And do you know, I love that. Mm-hmm. I absolutely love that. The idea that we're helping people by laughing, we're helping people to come to terms with their own imperfection, because it's something we all have to do. It's a strange thing that we're society bombards us with these images of all these people who are doing better than us, you know, bungee jumping and, you know, ski boarding and, you know, having a great life, apparently. Rather than sitting watching telly eating some Haagen-Dazs, which is what I consider having a great life. And we can feel inadequate. I went to a psychiatrist once, and the psychiatrist said that they'd been in business for 30 years and that everybody had the same problem.
Wow.
And I remember thinking, that can't be right. That's too simple. It's too simple. And he said, everybody thinks they're not good enough. Mm. And it is simple when you think about it. Mm. That is the root of 99.9% of problems.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was a game changer for me. But, I loved being in comedy and working. And obviously I started off doing poems, and I was given a program called Packet of Three.
Mm-hmm.
And that brings me to my next object, actually.
Lovely. Well, we move on from your mum's beautiful photograph, which goes into the time capsule as your second item. So let's have number three then. Right, as is the way with podcasts of this length, we have to interrupt it for a small ad break, the oil that keeps the podcast wheels turning. So, thanks for listening. We'll be back in a moment.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome back. Right, let's get straight back to Henry Normal and discover what else he's chosen from his life to put in a time capsule.
So number three is my wedding ring. to my wife, Angela.
Yeah.
And I've no idea where it is.
Like most men.
So if you could get that back for me, that would be lovely. It's in a drawer somewhere, is the thing. So I met Angela up in Manchester, and I was working on the Mrs. Merton show at the time. So I'd had a show called Packet of Three, and it was funnily, it was originally called Normal Services, because I was approached in Edinburgh. It was the John Blair Film Company, and they'd asked John Egley if he wanted a show, and John Egley's brilliant, as you know, and he said that no. I've never spoken to him about this, but I don't think he quite trusted TV people at the time, and you know, there's some understanding of that. So I said, yeah, why not? So I was up there with Atty Aridge doing 30 shows, and I won, Michael. Now, this is not something I would normally admit, but I won the, in fact, I'm the only winner of the Daily Mail Young Comedian of the Year. Now, that's a weird one, isn't it? I've never told Steve this. He'd probably divorce me or something if I told him. But just before the Perrier gave, I think Ariel got the first one into the Young Perrier Award. The year before, the Daily Mail come up with this idea of having a Young, and they gave it me. And then, of course, when the Perrier had theirs, they didn't do it anymore. No. So I'm the one and only winner of this award. So I must have been, I must have done all right in a mainstream sort of way. And anyway, I was offered this thing. And I said, well, yeah, that'd be great. What's the show? And they said, well, we were thinking you'd tell us that. And I said, all right, okay. And I thought, I can't do an old show on my own. So I said, well, let's do the Muppets, but with real people, and I'll be the Kermit character, and we'll get Frank Skinner, because I love Frank Skinner, and he's very funny. And if you remember back at the time, Frank Skinner was not alternative in the way a lot of people were, you know, very left-wing. Frank, you know, used to do, for want of a more technical term, knob gags, which I used to find hilarious. So I said, let's get Frank as the Gonzo character, or the Fozzie Bear.
Yeah.
And I wanted Linda Smith, who I love to bits, to be the Miss Piggy, shall we say. Anyway, they decided that Linda Smith was too much like me, in that, you know, she was very wordy and whatever, and they wanted Jenny Eclair. And I'd not met Jenny Clay before, but as soon as I met her, she's absolutely brilliant, full of energy, and, you know, very, very funny. So it was quite a cartoon sort of show, in that we were playing exaggerated versions of ourselves. And I enjoyed doing the show. So we got 3.4 million viewers, which these days you'd kill for. But I remember walking around thinking, oh, I've not done very well. I've not done very well. It's that thing of not thinking that you're good enough, you know. Probably in the top 10 rated shows of BBC Two and Channel 4 at the time.
Yeah.
But I was a bit disenchanted with it. But we, when they did a second series, they sacked me off my own show, which was very strange. And I was very proud that we actually gave a lot of people their first, you know, because there's a lot of acts that were on, like Dave Gorman, and even Steve, his first actual character that he did, as opposed to, you know, his impressions, on national TV, was on that show. He played somebody purporting to be my brother, but was actually Frank's brother. You know, so I think we did 6 shows of all 45 minutes each, and we had 3 or 4 acts on each show. So it was a great learning curve for everybody doing that show. Anyway, I was sacked from the show because I think I was a bit too chummy, Michael. I think that's what he was. At the time, you had to be a bit cool. And I'm more your Bernie Winters, you know. Well, more your Snorbits, to be honest with you. At times, Mike Winters, which is the least fun of the three. But I still like him. I like all them old comedians. You know, there's no edge to them, was the thing. And so I think I was a bit uncool. So I took a back seat and said I'd be a writer as opposed to a performer. And Caroline got a show, the Mrs. Merton show. So she asked me to write on that. And there was me, Craig Cash, and Dave Gorman writing on that. And then Steve asked me to write his Paul Calf with him. So I was actually working strangely enough, on two shows at the same time. And I did that for, you know, about 15 years where I'd work with Steve and Caroline. So I'd work nights, I'd work weekends, I'd work in my lunch hour, trying to balance doing two shows at the same time. Mm.
It's sort of why I got out of production. For a short while, I was in production at Granada Television. Do you want to become a producer? They said. And I said, can I still act? And they said, no, you can't act and be a producer. And as we've discovered since, you bloody well can.
Well, you can. I sort of, because I was doing so much, I had to put the poetry on one side. So I spent about 25 years not doing the poetry. Obviously, I'm back doing it now. Mm. But I enjoyed sitting in a room with Caroline and Craig and Dave Gorman and having a laugh.
Yeah,
it was great. And we're being paid to have a laugh. And sitting with Steve and having a laugh, and it seemed odd that we're having such a laugh, and yet, you know, obviously because the shows were doing well, we were being paid well. Mm-hmm. So Dave went off to do his own thing, and he's become brilliant. And then we wrote The Royal Family. But around this time, I met Angela was the thing, and that gave me a stability that I felt my own life was, you know, sort of secure. Mm. So it was a lot easier to put myself into work, and felt there's a thing in there when you find a soulmate that you're building something, as opposed to, you know, sort of sailing from place to place. You're actually, you know, in a place and you're building something. So for me, the wedding ring, we only wore it for the wedding ceremony. Mm-hmm. Because Angela and I don't wear any pendants, rings or anything. But we thought, it's this thing about doing the right thing again. We thought we ought to have one. So we wore it for the day and then put it in a drawer and lost it.
Yeah, Henry, I've always thought that what's impressive is that you, unlike a number of top executives, and I will give you that title, you're not over impressed with yourself.
Well, I think when we started Baby Cow, so after I'd done The Royal Family, Steve gave me the option of writing a film, which became The Parole Officer. And Caroline and Craig said, will you come and do the second series? And I chose to do the film. And in retrospect, although The Royal Family went on to be, you know, an institution and brilliant, doing the film meant that Steve and I started Baby Cow production company. And I loved building Baby Cow because it meant that, again, I was dealing with people who wanted to have a laugh, but a lot of young people, which keeps you young, working with young people. And really, it was my job to get the best out of them. And what I tried to do was I tried to be the producer that I wanted when I was their age. You see, when I was on Packet of Three, because there was dark drapes, they made me wear a pink jacket. Now, I'd never wore a pink jacket up to that point, and I've never wore a pink jacket. I've got nothing against pink. I think pink's a lovely colour. I'm more of a goth by nature, so I'm more dark and gloomy, more Nick Cave-ish. And so, you know, I didn't feel comfortable. Of course, the other thing is, my material at that point was I'd do serious poems and I'd do funny poems. Some were short and some were long. But when you get to television, they only need the short, funny ones. Mm-hmm. So the balance of what you do then becomes more lightweight than you'd see me if you actually saw me do an hour on stage. Mm-hmm. So what I did with Pact of Three is I took on board that I'd felt uncomfortable doing it. And I said, right, what is it you want to do? And don't try and find out what other people, what do you want to do? And let's make that happen. So the first person we rang was Julia Davis, because we'd worked with her on Steve's tour and, you know, knew she was brilliant. To a certain degree, we had to work with young people because we were fairly young ourselves. And I think we were the first ever working class producers.
And you were definitely the first that hadn't gone to Oxford or Cambridge.
I think so, yeah. And so there was a sense that we had to prove ourselves, and a sense that, you know, we couldn't go to, the established comic actors and say, come and work for, you know, a couple of upstarts like me and Steve. But going to people that we'd worked with that were younger, like Julia, that was great. So we spoke to Julia and she said, well, I've got a mate called Rob Brydon. Do you want to meet him? And we said, all right, then. And he came round and he got a tape in his hand that he'd done 10 minutes. It was called Marion and Jeff. Mm. And we put it in the television, this little pilot. And Steve, at the end of it, was looking out that window and I was looking out the other window because we both had a tear in his eye. And we didn't, you know, we felt slightly, you know, sort of embarrassed, didn't want to catch each other's eye. And we said, we'll see if we can do that. So we had two projects. We had Marion and Jeff and we had Human Remains.
Which is still, to this day, one of my favourite comedy shows of all time.
And it's a brilliant show. And they do these six characters. And what was great was that we were helped by the BBC, because the BBC were very keen to help Steve at that time. I don't think they were that bothered about me, to be honest with you. But, somebody had to do the proper work whilst Steve did the more extravagant stuff. But we were very keen that the first show would not be Steve Coogan show, it would be somebody else. So we made these two shows and they both won RTS awards. And it was a lovely moment. I remember sitting with Julia Davis sat next to me and Jane Root, the head of BBC Two, on the other side of me. And I felt like Julia's dad at that point. It was quite a lovely feeling to have helped somebody to this point where, you know, they're picking up an RTS award. And I would say that's one of the loveliest moments of my career, mm-hmm. Julia getting that award, and Rob got an award as well for Marion and Jeff. So we were off and running at that point, and we made over 450 comedy shows, a dozen films, and all manner of stuff like animations and tried lots of different things, a few radio series and stuff like that. So I was at Baby Cow for 17 and a half years before I retired.
Yeah.
But I loved it to bits, and I loved all the people that we worked with. Very often coming and doing their first ever television. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you think about some of the household names, we did a show. There was a point, I'll tell you, there's a point where I thought in the first 2 years where I thought we were going to collapse because we were doing scripted comedy and we didn't have any scripts. That's classic for a scripted comedy business. You need scripts. And we'd done the first two shows and we did a show which I wrote the script with Graham Duff, who was the main writer, and Steve, which was Dr. Terrible. So we'd spent a lot of time doing that. And when we came out the back of that, I'd not got another show to make because we hadn't any scripts because we'd been spending this time doing that. So I'd taken on some employees by this time. So I thought, well, what are we going to do? And I got a meeting with the head of BBC Three, Stuart Murphy. And I went to bed, and I went to bed in my suit. I just pulled the clothes over me and got home. And I thought, how am I going to survive? How am I going to survive this? And I thought, that's a good name for a show. How am I going to survive? So I thought, well, I know what we'll do. So I went to see Stuart Murphy, and I said, I've got this show called How to Survive, and it's How to Survive Weekends, How to Survive Parents, How to Survive Crime and everything. And what we do is we get 50 stand-up comedians and that have never been on television, and we film them in different locations. We put some music where I get from Fatboy Slim's company, and we'll get some animation, and we'll make like a real sort of funky mix of stuff, and we'll put that on BBC Three, and you'll get 50 new comics on BBC Three that have not been. So we got John Bishop, Jimmy Carr, Alan Carr, Robin Ince, just loads of people that are now household names.
Yeah.
That was the first show.
That's the astonishing legacy, isn't it? When you look back, you think to yourself, oh, my word, all those people, how would they have got on otherwise? Because there was a closed door system almost for people like that.
It was odd. It was odd. But I mean, BBC Three was a breath of fresh air, and Stuart Murphy was up for taking a chance. After I made that show, I said to him, I said, I can do the same show cheaper with poets. And he said, all right then. So I got Lem Cisse, John Cooper Clarke, all my favourite poets in the country, all the ones that I knew could perform. And I did some shows with that. And then Stuart, God bless him, when he saw that, he said, do you think you could do Shakespeare? And I said, what, these soliloquies? He said, yeah. I said, yeah, we'll get some like young actors in. So I got all the young actors, you know, Ralph Little and people like that. People you wouldn't think of, Alistair McGowan, Mira Sayal, I think did one, doing all these Shakespeare soliloquies. And we did it as like a stream of consciousness. So they had a theme to each show. And by the time I'd made those three shows, we'd got some scripts. So we were able then to make a scripted show because we'd, you know, I'd spent nearly a year doing the other shows.
So in fact, that old adage of, if you're not busy, look as if you're busy.
That's right. Well, do something.
Yeah.
One of the other highlights for me was we won an international award for Moonboy, international Emmy for Moonboy, which was glorious as well. You know, I say you don't think that these things are within the possibility, you know, and then when they are, and obviously when we made Philomena, which I was a producer on, you know, and it got nominated for 4 BAFTAs. I thought actually, Michael, at that point, I thought I'd peaked. I thought, you know, I think it made over 150 million worldwide. So I thought, that's probably going to be the biggest thing I've worked on.
And did it cover Judi Dench's wages?
You know, she was gorgeous. When I first met Judi Dench, I said to her, I said, Judi, I've written for you. I wrote you a sex scene. She said, no, darling. I've never done a sex scene in my life. I said, you have. It was for BBC Nature. And I had to write the sex life of a slug. And I remember writing like 4 pages of this stuff. And she read it so slowly that I had to knock a page off. So, you know, I've still got a page of slug sex jokes knocking around somewhere. It's unused. And she's, oh, yes, darling, yes, yes. So my claim to fame is I've actually written the only Dame Judi Dench sex scene.
She's a fantastic woman.
Oh yeah, she's quality and fun, and you know,
yeah.
And I think that film, I think it, you know, it's Steve's best film, and he worked really hard, and Jeff Pope, who co-wrote it with him, worked very hard. It's a great film, and the testament to it was that the woman Philomena herself loves the film.
Great.
No, she got to meet the Pope as well.
Really?
Steve took her to meet the Pope, and considering the story is quite a moment.
Did he ask the Pope if he knew where your ring was? That's what you need.
No, but that's a very good tie-in. I love a back reference. So
thank you very much. All right, well, we'll take that then and put it in as your third item. So let's move on.
Yes. Now, I should mention the one I want to lose, or do we do that at the end?
Let's do it now, and then let's get that out of the way.
Well, the one I'd like to lose is the knit comb. Do you remember the knit comb? It was like a metal comb that was very thin slits in it. So the prongs of the comb were very sturdy. At school, you had to line up when the knit nurse came, and she'd, you know, check you for them. And if you got any lice, I think they're called, the eggs of the they'd comb them out, and you get some stuff to put on. Now, at school, I'd never got knits at school. But I remember about the age of 13, my mum had died, and my dad was taking us to see his dad. So we'd get dressed up, you know, in his best clobber. And my dad looked in my ear, and it was all flaky. And a lot of the kids along the road had like skinhead cuts. So skinheads became very popular because you'd have less knits.
Yeah.
But I didn't have that. I had a short back and sides. And he thought, I got knits, and we're going to see his dad. And this whole thing about, you know, doing the right thing and looking the thing. So he got the knit comb, and he scraped my scalp raw. And what I realise now is it wasn't knits, it's psoriasis. So he'd scraped off all the psoriasis from my head very painfully. Mm. Now, he's not to know this, and I don't resent it, but I didn't find out I'd got psoriasis till about 8 years ago, and when I got some on my back. And then all the spots that I'd had as a teenager on my legs became apparent that this was something I've had all my life. So we were talking earlier about this idea of coming to terms with imperfection. Mm. And so I think for people that are in the communications business, I think it's good for us to let people know that we have imperfections and that it's natural. I mean, a lot of people have psoriasis, you know, a lot of people have it far worse than me. It doesn't change anything of you other than it's just an irritant that you've got. Mm. But people do tend to, if they have any imperfection, they tend to hide it, don't they? They tend to, you know, not admit to it in some way, as though, you know, as though it's like the plague or lurgy or something like that.
Rather like your dad would have thought. I mean, clearly, yeah, you getting nits or him thinking you had nits, in a way, you would have been to an extent to blame for that.
Yes, yeah, because I'd been near somebody who got nits, mm, as though, you know, as though that is the way you work as a kid. You know, I won't go near that person, they might have nits. You know, it wouldn't occur to you, would it?
No, the nit comb went completely out of fashion for a while because they developed shampoos that would just, you know, you just put them on, didn't need to do the nit comb. So nobody had a nit comb for, I suppose, probably through the 80s, 90s. And then, of course, the nits became immune to these shampoos. And now now the nit comb, if you want to find nits on a child now, there's only one way. You put some conditioner in their hair so it's nice and smooth, which was a kindness they never showed us, I seem to remember.
Oh, yeah.
And then
yeah,
you comb through and see if there's anything on it. And so the comb has come back.
I don't think I ever had any conditioner on my ear until I left home. And so that would be the thing that I would lose.
Yeah.
But so my final choice.
Yeah. Okay. We'll move on to your final number five.
You'll see behind me some paintings.
Yeah.
So these are done by my son, and all my books have my son's paintings on the cover, mm-hmm, which I love to bits. He paints every day. So my son, Johnny, is 23 now. He's autistic. He's severely autistic, but he loves painting, and he paints every day. So if you work it out, in a year we've got 365. He's 23. He started painting when he was about 7. I have no room in the garage. Is the thing? I have no room in several showers and bathrooms, and every bit of the wall in our place has got his paintings. He likes doing big paintings. I wish he'd do miniatures because he's costing me an absolute bloody fortune. But he's a big lad. He's 6'3", and he likes to do big paintings. And I love them to bits. And I love the fact that he enjoys the process of painting. So you and I work in the creative industries, and you know, and sometimes it's nice when you've done something and you can appreciate it, and sometimes when you're doing it you can appreciate it. And the great thing about I find with Johnny is when he paints, he dances, and that love of the actual doing of the thing is so evident that it's made me want to enjoy more the process of writing poems, the process of performing poems, process of when are you doing something creative, to actually enjoy being in the moment.
I wasn't aware of autism particularly for much of my life. And then we did a program together on Radio 4, I don't know if you remember, but the With Great Pleasure. And I read some of your choices that you picked as the writing that you liked. And I read that piece from...
Oh, yes. Yeah, The Curious Case of the Dog in the Night.
The Curious Case of the Dog in the Night, yeah. And yeah, I remember talking to you about it, and the description you gave to the audience was that you liked it because your son was autistic. Yeah. And I didn't know anything about autism, or I'd never come across anybody particularly autistic. And now my grandson has autism.
Oh, yeah.
Not as severely as your son, I would say, but it makes him a very particular person?
Well, I think a lot of people have got a degree of autism. They've called it a spectrum in the past. Are they calling it a constellation these days?
Right.
If you think about it, we all have great attributes. Like, I can't swim. My son can swim, right? So in that respect, he's achieved far more than others. As I say, I can't play the drums. My dad could play the drums. We have various areas of skill. Mm-hmm. So Johnny can paint and he can swim and he can do lots of things, but his communication in a verbal sense, he's not able to get the words. There's a great book by a Japanese lad who's probably in his early 20s now. Naomi is his first name. I'm not going to even attempt his second name because I'll get it wrong, but it's called The Reason I Jump. And he writes about the fact that if he's got the letters in front of him, then he can anchor the words. But if he hasn't got the letters in front of him, he can't communicate. And it's interesting that we think sometimes that when somebody can't communicate with us, it means that there's not the stuff going on. Mm. But the great thing is in the book, because he's found this way of anchoring the words, he can tell you what's going on. Now, if you see him, he's very much like my son in that he'll bounce around, he'll clap, he'll what they call stim, which is self-stimulating, mm-hmm. As means of controlling the world and controlling his own feelings, because it's easy to be overwhelmed. But when he's got the keyboard in front of him, you realize the complexity of his thought. And I would say he's as clever as I am, if not more. But you only are able to realize that because he's found this means of communication. So I find that we do find a lot of autism in the various ways that it's presenting itself at the moment all around the country. And people don't yet quite understand how to get the best out of people who are autistic, because there's a lot of worth and a lot of something to add to the world in autistic people, and it's a question of finding a way to utilize that. And I say, in my son's case, certainly one part of that is painting. So my last object would be one of his paintings. Now, which one? That's a very difficult question. I'm going to go for the cover of my book, The Escape Plan, because this is a huge painting and it's like sort of 6 foot by 6 foot. So obviously I couldn't, my book couldn't be that big. So I've obviously got a miniature version of it. But when I see it and I look at it, I think that's something I would never be able to do. I would never be able to express myself in that way. And with such boldness, with such courage. It's funny. So my son often says things from films as a way of anchoring words. And if you ask him, if you said you've got three wishes, what do you want to wish for? His first wish would always be courage. And which he obviously he's got from Wizard of Oz. But I love the fact that that's what stuck in his mind, that it is courage, because he has got courage. And he had an exhibition in Brighton of his work, and it was a huge exhibition, and it was on for a month. And I'm told that more people came to see that exhibition than any exhibition they'd had ever at the gallery. This is the Phoenix Gallery in Brighton, and I love the fact I've got a picture of him at the exhibition. It's quite strange, Michael, in that, as I say, he doesn't volunteer communication. If you're in a room with him, he'll sort of be easy, but he won't want to be confronted and he'll edge out. At that exhibition with all his paintings around him, we were going to make an announcement, so we put up a microphone. And I'm flogging some of his books because he's got his paintings in a book. And I can hear him on the microphone. And I'm thinking, this is... So he's saying, hello, 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 hello. And I'm thinking, what's he doing on that microphone? So I go to the microphone, and there's all the people, there's about 180 people in front of him. And you should see on the microphone, nobody's said to him to do this. And as I said, this is somebody that would, you know, leave a room if there were too many people in it. And I said, all these people have come to see your paintings. What do you want to say to them? And he said, thank you. Which is again, you know, this is as much of a conversation I've ever had with him. So he said, thank you, and I said, what do you think of this exhibition? And he said, is it good? Because very often when you say to him, is this good or is it bad? Right. So he'll pick the first bit of what you've said. Is it good? Which means it's good. Mm-hmm. And it was such a lovely moment. And again, if I think about the moments in my life, some of the things we've discussed today are the things I'd like to be reminded of when we open this capsule. So certainly one of my son's paintings would be in there.
Yes. But I remember at that time on the radio thinking how proud you were of your son then. And that's not changed at all.
No. You know, we all go through ups and downs, and we all have to find courage. And it's hard enough, I think, if you're neurotypical to find courage. But if you've got an extra difficulty to deal with, and this goes for many people with, you know, physical and mental difficulties and emotional difficulties, you know, I think we don't realize the amount of courage it takes for people just to get through a day. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I've been doing with my poetry is to try and tap into this whole idea of life's not made up of all the stuff they're showing you we do on the television. All that extreme sports stuff and all the shots of the sunset and, you know, the people sipping champagne. I've been in those scenes. I've been at places which can be the loneliest place, you know, if you're sipping champagne at some do and you're not feeling it and you're not with the people that you love. You know, this podcast that you're doing is quite interesting because it makes you examine the memories that you have as to what are the important things. And, you know, things like we've gone through today, things like a mince pie from being a kid and, you know, a picture and, you know, a painting. They're the symbolism and the what they entail are particular to you. Mm. And that's what makes them important, I think. They're not generalized off the peg.
Absolutely not.
Thank you for inviting me onto the podcast today and making me reflect.
Well, thank you for doing it. It's been really lovely to hear it. Thanks, Henry.
You've got a great ability to do this. If it was something you wanted to get into, you'd be great at it.
So. From you, I take that as a great compliment. Thank you, Henry. And of course, typically, my reaction to that immediately is, no, I'm not good enough. You have been listening to My Time Capsule with me, Mike Fenton-Stevens, and my guest, Henry Normal. I hope you enjoyed our conversation. If you did, then perhaps you'd like to dip your toe into the large lake of other Time Capsule-based chats I've had. There are over 150 to choose from so far, and if you subscribe to this podcast, you will be informed whenever a new one is available to listen to. Yes, a person will come round and knock on your door and say that... No, it'll be sent to you over the internet. Please take the opportunity to rate this show on your podcast app. You may even want to go the whole hog and write a review. Or you may not. It's not obligatory, but it's always much appreciated. You can find out what we're up to by following me or My Time Capsule on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook, and you can download or stream the theme tune by Pass the Peas Music on Spotify, without me chatting all over it. This has been a cast-off production for Acast. The producer was John Fenton Stevens. Right, it's nearly Christmas, so I'm going to order myself one of those festive pizzas you can get round this time of the year. Not the turkey and cranberry. Nah, don't fancy that. I thought I'd go for the good King Wenceslas. Yeah, it's deep pan, crisp and even.
Now, I may have done that joke last Christmas. It's difficult to remember. And anyway, although this episode was released in December, you may be listening to it for the first time in June. That's how podcasts go. In which case, are we having lovely weather at the moment? / shit weather at the moment. Delete as applicable. Bye.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.